greet you all in Jesus' name this morning. Good to be here with you this morning. Yeah, I hope I made the right decision with my voice. When I saw the smoke go, I thought, well, now maybe I can do this. But we'll see. There's one of the things that is always warmed my heart when I see a verse, a common verse that we all see, know about, and then I look at it more carefully, and it unfolds itself in a way that I just couldn't imagine before. And so that's the case this morning. I think many of you might have memorized Psalms 1. And in the second verse in Psalms 1, it says this: "But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law does he meditate day and night." And so I just, I was thinking about this and just got more and more thoughts from this. And I want to give you these thoughts. Law of the Lord, his delight is in the law of the Lord. Now, I thought maybe, first of all, maybe we should define what the law of the Lord is. Maybe your first thought is, what's the Ten Commandments? But I believe it's more than that, because understanding God's law makes us to be able to understand God himself. God and the law can really be separated. That's who he is. It's the law is exactly what it is. He's not giving us anything special that he himself is not. It's in his personality. He is righteous and just and merciful, and that's who he is. And his law is his own personality. As I was thinking of this, I was thinking of each one of you has a personality, and each one of you has a standard, a law unto yourself that you do not step across. Some of these laws, of course, that you have in your own personality can be sinful, but others are neutral. It doesn't matter which way you go. I know you have your standards, for instance, in washing dishes or how clean you get them, or let's say in how you do your carpentry work. I've had people working for me where I'm talking framing work, where a quarter inch didn't make any difference. And others, they had to get it down to an eighth. And a few had to get it to a 16th or less. Or, you know, even in troweling concrete, there some of them left a crease. Oh, that's all right. That gives character. Another man says he wants to smooth it out. But that's the standard that is within us. And I think to a certain extent you can change standards. But I'm finding out that it's hard for people who... to change a standard, for instance, for somebody who is doing carpenter work to constantly, completely change to where he goes down to the 16th of an inch. He's going to be a quarter incher all his life most of the time. But anyway, God and his commandments. Let's just take the Ten Commandments, although I don't want to stop there. It's part of it. But it's a good part because it shows us what God is. Who God is and what he's thinking. Four of the commandments are our relationship with God, God's relationship to us. And six of them, the other six, are a relation to our fellow man. Now, according to Jesus, he's repeating something in the Old Testament, although he made it stronger. He says that all of the law and the prophets, not sure if he said law and prophets, but anyway, the law is all comprised into what it says in Leviticus 19:18, love thy neighbor as thyself, and love thy God with all thy heart. Anyway, the first four, I read somewhere where it says that the first four have to do with God's right to the man he created, the rights of God. What right do I have to him? And so the first one, it says, no other gods before me. And so God requires allegiance. Well, let's say he has a right to allegiance. He created us, has a right to our allegiance. The second one, make no other image or make no other definition of God. I'm God. I'm this God that I hope I can explain this morning a little bit. The third one is don't take the name of the Lord in vain. He has a right to our reverence. And the last one of the four is he has a right to your time. The Sabbath day, keep it holy. He has a right to having 1/7 of your time. And now the last 6 have to do with our fellow man. To honor your father and mother is, each person has a right to be respected for who you are. The second one has to do with killing or murder. Every person has a right to life. God has given this to us. The next one is that you should not break a marriage relationship. You have a right to a covenant marriage relationship. Do not steal is the next one. You have a right to personal property of sorts. You should not be stealing from people. And the other one is false witnesses. You have a right to honest representation of yourself. And God is giving these things. He's giving this in the line of love thy neighbor as thyself. The last one is a secure existence. In other words, covetousness. When people covet, they want what you've got and they're going to try to get away from it. But you have a right to have a secure existence. Now, anyway, God, that is God. That is the laws of God, particularly as you come in the Ten Commandments. But there's other laws that, let's remember, that we're studying this to know what to meditate upon. Okay, the other one is the ceremonial law. Now, the Old Testaments had their old covenant ceremonial laws to meditate on. And I'm sure that was one of the things they did. But the New Testament also has ceremonial laws. Let's not forget that. We have baptism, communion, headship veiling, and I think there's 4 others, particularly that we put an emphasis on as far as the ceremonial part of it, where you do an outward thing to signify a spiritual meeting. I have to think of the writers of the old of this verse. As he said this, he said, meditate day and night. I have to think of him as an example of studying the ceremonial laws and meditating on them. I wonder if he was meditating and thinking about this and laying awake at night and thinking of the feasts. What do these feasts mean? What does God want these little bit of bizarre feasts and the sacrifices and the red heifer and the washings and the incense and the bitter herbs? He had a lot to think about, and it's great to think about these things. They are the things that God put there in a mysterious way for us. I can just imagine the interest and the allure and the experience of the search, looking into this, and maybe God smiling as he's thinking of the mystery and of his of his child seeking and meditating on these things. but even when we know most of the fulfillment of this ceremonial law, which we do, we still are trying to put the puzzle together. We're on the other side of the mystery being revealed. My dad spent 40 years studying and searching with a lot of joy and interest into these things, with a lot of thirst and love. But he never, and I never, of course, totally even understand that part. But we have the New Testament ceremonial laws to meditate and seek into in our times of day and night searching. But there's other laws. Excuse me. The civil law. Now, the civil law in the Old Testament, God called his people to do the civil law, but not in the New Testament, because all races and nations and people are called into one. And God separates this responsibility today. We believe in the separation of church and state today, and the New Testament does say that. But I have to think of other laws. I have to think of the law of creation, the law that got by God established at creation. And here there's a lot to meditate on and to take interest in the study. I have to think of the laws of math, for instance, the numbers. And we can see God in these. We can see him in the decimal system. It's amazing how that 10 works out. 7 doesn't work. 10 does. Or the law of pi, the circumference of a circle. I could just name a lot of things in math. Or the laws of science, like gravity and magnetism and light. They work astronomy and biology, they all work, and they're there. They are laws, and the scientists today have no idea why they work, but they work, and they're there. So we might assume that these laws have always been there. God made these laws according to his personality and his nature, and he said they were good. And I just have to think, as I was here on the first morning of school, I just think of all these children and how the more they study these things, the more they can praise God and they can see God. They can see God in these things. And I think if it's still true that in the front of the booklets it gives us why they study these things, so they can see God in these very things and they can praise and worship him intelligently. We can only worship intelligently if we know what we're worshiping about. So again, I want to just say that maybe people assume that the laws in the Bible are a thing apart from God, and that he wants us people on the earth to do that. But that's not, you know what? Maybe they're thinking that someday he's going to make another world and then he's going to change these laws. But God is unchanging. And this very nature of law, of God, is in these laws. He's, or should I call them standards? They call them law in the Psalms here. But this is God. These laws are God. They're the together. And they express God's nature in everything: respect, love, mercy. And in the New Testament especially, he emphasizes the laws that God really wanted to teach in the Old Testament. The Old Testament was a schoolmaster to teach us what he really wanted to teach us in the New Testament. So the Anabaptists always believed that there was a law of Christ, which is all of the things on the Sermon on the Mount: love, joy, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, peace, and all the rest. I have had to think as I was studying this how fortunate we are that our God is not an unorganized, unloving, vindictive God that many of the people worship today. I'm using the God in small letters. The heathens, they think they have to appease him. Of course, they're not worshiping God. They're worshiping Satan in a sense. But to meditate and to delight ourselves into these things brings a certain fulfillment and a peace and a joy that cannot be done any other way. And it brings us in a right relationship with God, and it helps us to know God. And so anyway, in the first part of the verse, what is the law of the Lord? The law of the Lord is God. It's everything about him. It's all the things in the scripture. It's not the Ten Commandments only. It's everything. And that's who God is. But let's go to the second one. It says that he doth meditate day and night. His delight is on them and meditates day and night. So let's define what meditating is talking about. As I was thinking of this, I want to say this maybe first of all. There is a dark side of meditating. And maybe you don't have to know this necessarily, but maybe you should know it for the sake of watching what books you read on this. It's a cultish side, the occult. And non-Christians, and even maybe professing Christians unknowingly and maybe even knowingly, are involved in this. The idea of this meditating is where you open your mind up. You empty your mind of all thoughts and any laws of the Lord or anything. You just empty it completely up and allow anything to enter that you can imagine at that time. Just allow it to enter. No standard of anything. Just allow it to come in. And, of course, guess who comes in? It's the God of this world who comes in. And it's darkness. It doesn't seem like darkness, but that's exactly what it is. It's like an angel of light. And they think it's an angel of light, but the truth of it is it's not God. They call it contemplate, I can't even think of the adjective side of that. But anyway, can't pronounce it. But to contemplate and meditate is the name of this. And it's not the Creator God. It's a dark God of this world. And but there's a genuine side of that. Or maybe I should first say that yoga is an example of this, where people sit there in a certain posture, and then they open their minds up, and it's so peaceful and so everything. There could be a side that isn't dark, but I think it's very risky to do that. There needs to be a standard to come to these times. But there is a genuine side. That's exactly what he's talking about here and what I want to explain, where you contemplate and meditate. To meditate would be, what are your thoughts? What are you doing with your thoughts? And using our thinking capacity to see about God and what this is all about. I thought, just for a moment, let's pause to admire what God does to your thinking ability and to your mind and your brain. It is a marvelous and awesome creation that God made, and he made it unique to man. There's nothing like it, absolutely nothing like it. I'm going to quote out of Acts and Facts, which is, can't think of the ministry, but anyway, it's in there. Okay, I'm quoting out of there. Recent researchers, now, this was not necessarily Christian researchers. I'm not even sure if they were Christians. But this is what they said. The brain is an engineering marvel, and it's beyond anything imagined, to the point of being beyond belief. This is more recent research that comes out. The more they research, the more they find out how God is. They won't admit it, many, but nevertheless. Then he continues on to say, a single human brain has more information processing units than all the computers and routers and internet connections in all the earth. That's amazing. They're talking about one single human brain. The thing that you got between your two ears to this morning is an amazing piece of equipment. Now, having such an incredible processing machine, to meditate and to think and to go across what this verse is talking about, it can be used to tremendous good or tremendous evil. You know, every waking moment, your mind is processing something. You cannot be awake without it doing. Even daydreaming doesn't work. I remember my English teacher when I was in high school, she would allow us to say, I don't think. She said, no, you probably aren't thinking. But the truth of it is, you do think. So are we thinking good things? Or are we thinking bad things? You know, you have to catch yourself, because you can go down the wrong track and be thinking of things that you think are innocent but can be very detrimental. Or thoughts that can grow into things that can get you really in trouble. Are we thinking thoughts about ourselves or about others? Are we thinking God's laws? Are we meditating on the things of God? And I don't have to be on the Ten Commandments. It could be on the beauty of nature and all things. Now I'm going to quote partially. I redid a little bit, quoting from the Calvary Messenger. Do we dwell on past hurts? Thinking, I'm going back to meditating and thinking. If we think about past hurts, that's a sure recipe for bitterness and depression. So during the time that you're washing your dishes or nailing boards or whatever you're doing, do you dwell and meditate on good things? Or do you dwell on sensuality or the world or bad music or movies or actors that you think, or sex or rebellion or hatred, or imagine all kinds of evil things about different things? You know, if we meditate on those things, if our thoughts are those, and you can't be not thinking anything, don't forget, if you've got to meditate either something good or bad, we become like that. That's why in the worst cases of people letting their mind go where it wants to go, terrible crimes have been committed. Out of the blue, people say. The friends and neighbors say, I just could not imagine that this person was that type of a person. Well, he wasn't, not long before. They say he was a nice boy. Maybe he's a little quiet, But we had no idea that he was going to go out there with a gun and kill 30 people. No, they didn't have any idea because it was still on the mind when they remembered him. And it only came out when it was conceived, when it bore forth fruit. So, therefore, because of this dangerous thing that you have, potentially dangerous, I should say, it's not dangerous, but it could be, we must discipline ourselves and our thoughts and control it and take a hold of it. It can't have free reign. You can't let it go where it wants to go. You got to stop that. And it starts little and innocent often. Actually, if you'd start out in the bad, worst thoughts, you'd reject them immediately. You've got to start when they're little. James 1:5 says that when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin and death. So don't let it conceive to start with. It's awfully little when it conceives. And then in 2 Corinthians, it says, 2 Corinthians 10:5, it says, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. You take those thoughts and you bring them into captivity. You don't allow them to go anywhere. You stop them. You quit those things. Continuing on with another little angle of to delight ourselves and to meditate, we need to meditate on the things of God and the kingdom of God. And then Philippians 4, it says, I think you all know this verse, it says to think on good things, to think on pure, just, virtuous things, good report and praise and so forth. And day and night you think of these. Yeah, we have to work, and you have to give your employer your mind during those times, but they're not filled with good or bad. It's neutral things in that time. I'm sure there's lots of time when that, but he's using this analogy of day and night. We must, whenever your waking moment, that you have time and it's not on neutral things or things you have to do, then we must delight ourselves in the things of God. We could think about it maybe as an attitude, as an interest in the things of God and to every chance we have. And there is a great reward for such commitment. According to the second verse, which I didn't read, it says, it talks about how that the tree brings forth its fruit and all that. And then the very last phrase, it says, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. I love that. I really love that. Maybe he's speaking mostly in a spiritual sense in the New Testament, but the truth of it is it enters over into the physical side. The blessings you receive by that type of a thing are fulfilling and joyful. So if you want to live a victorious life, and I know you do, you must delight yourself in God and God things. For instance, I'll just give you examples of maybe you could delight yourself in the Bible verse you read each day at times. And the beauty of nature. I see God in nature. Just it's so beautiful and so wonderful. I just can't help but thank the Lord often as I walk through his nature. Or maybe it's God working in mankind. You know, for instance, this hurricane, you have all kinds of ideas. People have two different versions of it, and I agree with the one version that God is who he is. And do you see God in working in mankind? You know, if your spiritual eyes aren't open, if you haven't adjusted your eyes and trained your mind to see God in it and what it is, then we need to work at it. And that's why we should meditate. I saw one of the examples. This woman said nature is punishing the Republicans with this hurricane. And then another man, which I agree with, was a Christian man, obviously, said, you know, God isn't necessarily punishing anybody. Perhaps we can see God in it. Maybe he's bringing people to the Lord. But if not, in any case, that's what we should be doing. Well, maybe I'm going to continue here. What to think about and what to meditate. How do you display Christ's teaching? How do you display the fruits of the Spirit? just imagine and think of how can I best do that, the Sermon on the Mount. Or how about thinking of the needs of others, not about yourself all the time, but what you can do. And one of the things I think is so important for Christians to do is to be interested in other people's lives, not just your own. And then also, maybe you can imagine and think and meditate how to teach your children to worship God. This is part of meditating on God and His laws and His things. To worship God and to teach your children to follow your own convictions. Another aspect of meditation I'd like to talk about is the act of remembering. Meditation should be on remembering to certain things or on things. I want to read another quote from Acts and Facts talking about memory. Yet another recent discovery revealed the incredible level of memory storage in the human brain. A real bombshell, said a leading scientist in the field of neuroscience. Our new measurement, remember this is just recent, I just got this a week ago. Our new measurement of the memory capacity increases conservative estimates by a factor of 10 to at least a petabyte. I don't know what petabyte is, but it looks pretty big. At least a petabyte in the same ballpark as the World Wide Web. Can you imagine that? That your brain has got the capacity. I don't know how they do all of that, but it's got the capacity. I mean, how they estimate that. But this is non-Christian. So now I'm going to quote from Calvary Messenger again. I'm afraid we're losing our memory because of our use of computers. I wonder if our children will remember even our own zip code without going straight back to the computer and checking it out on Google. Some of that was my own words. Somebody said the world's next great division will be between people who wish to be creatures and people who wish to live as a machine. And it's between those who use memory and those who don't. Okay, some of the things that is important about memory is remembering our past. You know, remembering our past can be painful. It is for me because I think of the regrets and the things that took place, and I think of bad things that took place in the past. But if we avoid remembering, we avoid learning. When we meditate on God, that's what we need to do. We need to reflect on our actions in the past and how God taught and did this to us. And we need to learn from that. So there's a place to just sit and be quiet and think about this, maybe on your knees before God, and listen to what God has to say, listening in the sense of remembering in the past. The University of Virginia did a study with people. They were asked this. Okay, sit alone in silence with nothing but their own thoughts. Something people have struggled with evidently by what he's saying here. You either do that, sit alone in silence with nothing but your own thoughts, or suffer an electric shock. It says two-thirds of the men and one-fourth of the women chose the electric shock. I'm not sure why the women didn't choose that, but they, whatever reason. Also, we must remember other people's experiences of the past. If we don't learn from the past, we are doomed to repeat it. I know you know that little phrase. Let's not let that valuable instruction of remembering go unheeded and go back to it and check it. We need to train our minds in remembering. Let's hope that it's not true what this person suggested, that all this machinery and technology that we have makes us lose our memory. And we need to train our minds. Memorize scripture. Memorize hymns and prayers and poems. If you memorize one verse a day or in several days, I checked into it. You'd have learned in one year's time, you'd have memorized most of the Ephesians, Colossians, and Philippians. I think it was up close to 400 by the time we were with those three. But anyway, two of them, you can learn two epistles in 1 year. And I wish I would have learned more. I know my teacher, bless her heart, made us memorize a lot, and I did. And I did it simply because it's what you do. But today I wished I'd have done much more because I remember those things. I just really encourage you to do that. But then we need to use those verses and live by them and pray over them. On your knees, say, Lord, what does this verse mean? How can I apply this to my life? Meditate on them. And how can I be the person that you want me to be? How can I delight in the law of the Lord and meditate on it day and night? I think now is the time to fulfill this verse, is to do these things, because our days are not, we don't know how long we're going to last. I want to close with this poem. You might have seen this too, also in a recent magazine. This was written by a man who was born in 1860, and you've heard the story only, or excuse me, you've heard the poem or the words, "Only one life, 'twill soon be passed." Here's the first one, and I think there's about eight actual verses, but I'll only read two. Two little lines I heard one day, traveling along life's busy way, bringing conviction to my heart, and from my mind would not depart. Only one life, 'twill soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, a few brief years, each with its burdens, hopes, and fears, each with its clays I must fulfill. Living for self or his will, only one life, 'twill soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, yes, only one. Now let me say, thy will be done, and when at last I hear the call, I know I'll say 'twas worth it all. Only one life, 'twill soon be passed. Excuse me. Only what's done for Christ will last. Hope that we can take that with us, and with a zeal, realizing that there's only one life, and you might as well make the best of it. Not only might as well, but let us make the very best of that life. I'm going to close with that.